Hey, you are listening to Night Terrors Radio with Ash Hamilton and HorrorFix.com. We are back with Vincent DeSanti, who, it's been 3 years since we had you on a mic talking about Never Hike Alone. I got to admit, time compression notwithstanding, it does not seem like three. It does, but it doesn't, right?
I know. It went by really fast. Well, it went by fast and it didn't. I mean, since Never Hike Alone, it's been a really cool adventure for me where I went on the, you know, the film festival circuit and the convention circuit because I had to go out and find the fans who didn't know about Never Hike Alone. You know, we had a very good launch in 2017. We were very impressed by the fact that people even figured out who we were, where to find us. You know, we had the opportunity to open up a Telluride Horror Show, which really helped. So Birth of His Death and Horror Fix and Probably Disgusting and all these publications came out with reviews. And the fans seemed to like it, and that was a good thing. Friday the 13th fans had something to celebrate for once in a long while. So it was a good time. And I think we knew and we realized that we made an impact, but we didn't, you know, that we had something and we needed to find more fans. And so I went on the road. I did a lot of time at like Horror Hound, and they did some House of Indie Horror at Days of the Dead. But then, you know, traveled to different film festivals and got different experiences and met different horror fans. And along that way, heard a lot about people wanted to see a sequel to Never Hike Alone. People wanted to see a snow movie with Jason in it. And I had kind of all these ideas and all these premises and, you know, kind of juggling them around, and I laid them out. And at first I wanted to do Never Hike Alone 2, which was a direct sequel, which was a feature film. And at the time there was a glimmer of hope that maybe the lawsuit would end in a quick fashion, but it never did. And so the thought of trying to option a production company, Never Hike Alone, the feature film for the theater, I started to figure out how to just do it on my own with the help of the fans. And that was through a mini series. And that mini series would take this feature film script, split it up into three episodes. And then on top of that, fans are asking for a snow movie. So I came up with an idea for a snow short as well, to create a self-contained short in the world of Never Hike Alone in our universe, a universe world builder, but also brings back Tommy, introduces us to Rick Colon, and introduces us to some people in the town that we've never met before, but we know who Jason is. And we kind of get a glimpse of what life is like in Crystal Lake in modern times before the big changing event, which is Kyle MacLeod. Now, we all see what Kyle did to Jason and how he was able to get away. And that's the difference between him and everybody else in the last 30 years, is that he was able to get away with not only his life, but proof that Jason exists. So Jason can no longer hide. And Jason is now thrust out of his home to chase him down, especially now that Tommy has seen him. Like in Jason's perfect world, he killed everybody at the ambulance and disappeared again. But he doesn't have that opportunity, and now the Band-Aid is ripped. And in order to get back into that story and to be able to raise enough funds to tell the rest of that side of it, we know that with the money that we can raise, we can make these smaller productions that kind of do the same thing, focus on character development, give some really cool unexpected things that Friday the 13th fans won't really expect coming, but they're gonna learn a lot about our Tommy Jarvis and who he is and what he's been doing for the last 30 years, where Crystal Lake has been, who Sheriff Rick Colon and what he's like. You know, last time we saw Rick, he was locked in a jail cell and Jason lives trying to get out, and he got outsmarted by Tommy, and now he runs the town. You know, so it's to see their dynamic kind of again. It was kind of one of those things we didn't want to rush in a sequel. We didn't want to have everybody in a few scenes, you know, put 30 years worth of history into the beginning of a new film. It was like, why don't we rewind the clock a little bit and let's tell the story from Tommy's perspective. And so this is what we're doing right now, is working with Tom Matthews to create his story. And this is the launch pad for his story and sets him up for what happens in our next episode, Never Hike Again, which is the next kind of part in the series. But we want fans to focus on Never Hike in the Snow and the things that it's bringing to what we feel is not only like the Never Hike Alone universe, but just Friday the 13th in general, and seeing some things that we've always wanted to see. Taking the premise of Jason in the snow and, you know, using it to tell a story, something, a narrative we've never seen before in Friday the 13th. And we've seen glimpses of things, and now I'm digging deeper and I'm exploring those a little bit further. And I think fans will be very happy that there's a lot less adventuring towards the camp. We know where it is now. We don't have to play that game anymore. So we really get right into it. This episode's 25 minutes. So it plays like a pilot episode. This is the prologue to everything else that we're going to tell. It's more about enjoying this story and then getting into our bigger story. And from a production standpoint, that allowed us to simplify our production protocols, whereas Never Hike Alone, we made it over the course of 18 months with five people and like put little sequences together. Now we're working with full cast and crew. So we couldn't do it the same way anymore. And doing Never Hike in the Snow helped us kind of build our crew properly to now prepare ourselves for bigger challenges, which are this Never Hike Again sequel. And so the first episode is very similar to this episode of Never Hike in the Snow. So now we know we can mirror this production and we can create the same type of value and even extend it a little bit further. But then that episode that everyone's really rating for, which is the third episode titled Jason Takes Crystal Lake, that's where the budget's going to start to go up. And that's why we traveled around the country to make as many fans aware of us as possible, because it's going to take basically all of Friday the 13th fandom to kind of rally around us and help us make this happen. Because when we turn around and show you what the production costs for some of these ideas are, you're all going to have heart attacks. But we're showing the fans that we're willing and able to take that responsibility, and we are responsible with it and create content that they enjoy. So as long as, you know, we're serving what they want and we're, you know, we're staying on the straight and narrow with the fan film stuff, we want to continue this journey unless somehow the rights come unhinged and we have an opportunity to do it on the studio level.
You know, it's interesting because when you start looking at the studio sort of love-hate affair with horror franchises, or even independent franchises in general, you know, I sort of equate it to like maintenance sex. Like they come in, they throw a tiny little bit of romance at it. We got a little bit of money. We'll keep it alive. We need to go ahead and string the fans along. But we're really not. We're not investing anything major.
A long time ago, you know?
Exactly. The honeymoon is over as far as the studios are concerned. You know, even though these franchises prove in everything that comes out, you know, posthumous to the films, talking about games, anything that's tie-in merchandise, always, you know, does very, very well. But again, that kind of commitment just doesn't seem to take place. Now, let's go down the rabbit hole a little bit, if you will. So one thing that we saw in Never Hike Alone that we haven't really seen in Friday the 13th is every Friday the 13th film has sort of been a snapshot of the perfect Jason Voorhees summer. I mean, even when we get on a boat, even when we get in space, all the elements are basically saying, this is Jason's prime environment. This is how he functions. And we put people into that prime environment. And of course, our expectations, even for a survivor, is very, very low.
Yeah.
Now, and that to me embodies the franchise throughout the 80s and even the 90s. Mm-hmm. Because that time was different.
Yeah.
Everything allowed for, you know, that the perfect killing zone for Jason Voorhees. And then we start getting into the 2000s and everything changes. And it's interesting when we get to Never Hike Alone, because we see that change. Yeah. There's more of this histrionic perspective that we really haven't witnessed before. Mm-hmm. Was that intentional? I mean, or am I just taking way too much of a collegiate perspective on this, Vincent?
No, I think that was definitely kind of part of it, which was, you know, my criticisms of 2009 were characters. I didn't feel like I related to any of those characters, and I felt like they were left over from a movie that died a long time ago, a formula that, you know, and don't get me wrong, as a Friday the 13th fan at the time, I was like, just give me the formula and I'll be happy. And for some reason, it didn't taste the same. It just felt like stale. And so, you know, I was exploring different things about what could Friday the 13th do differently. That still had the spirit of what kind of made it scary for us as kids and as young adults, experiencing it for the first time, but recreating that now after everything that we've seen since then. And I wanted to, you know, I think for telling a story of one character, my first place where I was, and I think that this would have been the 80s movie, was somebody journaling in a book. You know, and it started with that type of premise of somebody on this backcountry adventure who's been traveling basically the Appalachian Trail, you know, all the way from Georgia to New Hampshire. And they come across Crystal Lake and they take the trail in there and they do it. And that's where the original story started. But as I started to develop it, I started to realize, I said, who journals anymore. Who writes in books? We type on tablets, and we leave selfies, and we do video vlogs. And so very quickly it evolved into maybe he's doing it with his phone, and we'll make it a short. He's just walking around the camp, and within his story on Instagram, he gets attacked by Jason, which is something that could happen. And eventually that evolved when we found the other camp, when we found that big camp, I realized that an Instagram story wasn't going to cut it for this big location. This had to be something that this guy could actually really explore. And we needed to cinematically tell it to actually do it justice. So that's when it evolved in him being a vlogger and me adjusting and saying, okay, if I'm going to have to do first person, I don't want to stay in first person. What are films that kind of give me the opportunity to not do that? I looked at 127 Hours. I looked at The Martian as the two kind of real key elements there. A little bit of, what's the movie? The Descent, I think, has a little bit of like camera footage in it and stuff like that. So seeing how a character using a camera could be used and utilized to do some first person stuff, but not have to like park its self in there the entire time and be forced to be first person with this person the entire time. So it allowed us to, it gave me, for my taste, the cinematic balance that I wanted. I could use found footage for what it could really be used for, which was scaring people when you needed to, putting the audience in front of the character and making them the first person through the room, which we did a couple of times and set that up. We allowed our character to interact with our audience without breaking the fourth wall, but talking to an audience that we know will be there when he cuts this footage together. And it gave us all those opportunities to tell story and really good stuff that, I mean, Friday the 13th just hadn't been told from that point of view anymore. And we weren't necessarily saying, all right, we're reinventing the wheel on Friday the 13th. All that was all I have is one actor. How do I make this work? And all I had to do was make that concept work and just keep the environment and the atmosphere of Friday the 13th surrounding him. And by blending those two things together, that's how Never Hike Alone basically kind of baked in the oven.
Well, we've definitely had a lot of time with Crystal Lake. We've had a lot of time with Jason Voorhees. We've had a lot of time with Tommy. We've had enough time for establishing our exposition on what these films are.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a sin to move forward. You know, and sometimes horror fans tend to play things pretty close to the chest, you know, and it's, you know, I fall into the same camp sometimes where we complain about that formula, but then we complain when we veer from the formula.
Right.
But in this sense, you know, we've had such an ongoing episodic portrayal of the same sort of events over and over again. I think we as fans were definitely hungry for something. And I think especially when we saw some of the first shots from Never Hike in the Snow, it seems so very simple when you really break it down. Like, oh, it's Jason and it's snowing.
Yeah. And it's, you know,
why hasn't this happened before? But it looks brand fucking new, and it's really exciting.
It is. I mean, it was really exciting to come up with the concept and knowing that the goal is to put a lot of blood in the snow. So you come up with something cool to do that. And we think that we've come up with a cool sequence of events that people are really going to love. I think one thing that we, you know, when we're looking at this, it's like if someone's saying that we're reinventing the wheel on Friday the 13th, we're really not. We're taking the elements that are there. We're just adding a little bit more to the formula. We're taking those things that in the 80s were enough when it was a simple gag, when it was a simple somebody steps into a room and an axe hits them in the face.
Yeah. Like
that was all they needed. Fans want to be, you know, a little bit more foreplay now. You know, they want to work it into the scene. They want a little tension. They want to feel for the character. They want to know who these characters are. So we try to bring that along with something impressive in the kill count. And luckily for us this time, unlike last time, we were funded up front. So on the back end, and the first time we did it, we were really like struggling to pay every dollar because we were only raising a little bit at a time personal wise. And then with what we raised in Kickstarter, it just gave us that one little boost to do like our first week. But other than that, it was still coming out of personal funds until we could do the campaigns afterwards to replenish all the debt that we took on to make the film. So this time the fans were out there in front of it. So now we had our money up front. And so that was nice to be like, okay, I know what I can do. I know what I can afford. How long does it need to take? Tell me when it's done and we'll go shoot it. And so it was really nice to be able to work some kills into this film and kind of bring that element back. And I think that fans are really going to appreciate our level of work there. And Nora Hewitt, who is our lead effects person, who did an amazing job on this. So we're looking forward to that. And then like putting that all in the snow was like kind of like the icing on the cake. I mean, it was, you know, you just kind of see it. I mean, when you're shooting in it and you see the blood hitting the snow and you're pouring blood all over the place and you're just going, this is why we're doing it. Like, this is what the fans want to see. And, I know that it's been hard for us to just be like keep our mouths shut about it because we want everybody to see it. And we're excited for the 13th because I think they're going to like what they've invested in.
Now, what were some of the challenges of actually filming with the element of snow? Because from a writer's perspective, I know when I start looking at a scene, I'll even crawl back from the idea of rain. Like, I'll eventually write light mist, and I'll be like, no, night. It's just night.
Well, I mean, we had gone under the assumption that we'd be going up during a time of the season where it's just a blanket of snow. And so we weren't thinking about it being snowing. We just thought about having snow on the ground. Well, we had a drought, and it didn't snow for 2.5 months while we delayed production from December to February. And all the snow that was up there for like 1 week melted. And so I went through a period for about a month trying to change the name of the movie and thinking about what would be a good name and how would the fans accept this? Like, the story wouldn't change. Do we just go and make Never Hike Alone 2 now? Like, lots of things ran through my head, but everything was already in production. So what am I going to do? So we got to make this story. And literally the week of, we checked the weather report and it says it's going to snow this week. It's going to be a full-on snowstorm. We're getting multiple inches. It's going to snow all weekend. And I was just like, I hope this is true because it moved. It moved 3 times. Like, and so we just kind of wrote it out. And it just so happened that the day that we were supposed to start shooting was the first time it snowed in Big Bear in like 3 months. And so we caught the first light. We were out there 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. We were up prepping, driving to locations and trying to prep where we were going to start shooting first. We shot from about 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. to catch the first wave of snow that came through. And then the sun came out and we waited. And then the clouds came back and we were rehearsing the first scene and there was barely any snow on the ground. There was just a little bit left over. The sun had already melted what was already there. And I remember I was rehearsing with Cortland the first shot and you just heard the wind like punch the trees. It was like, poof, and you're like, what was that? And then you feel the air shift and all of a sudden the snow started to come down and we're like, all right, here it comes, get ready. And so we basically, like a surfer in a wave, we were just spotting our wave. And as soon as the snow started to come in, we started shooting and we rode that snowstorm as far as we could that day. And we got a majority of that scene and then shot it out and then shot later that night. It snowed again that night. And then the next day we just had to shoot with the rest of the snow that was on the ground. And so we had to race that clock and like shoot through that snow. So it was a real time crunch. I mean, we were literally minutes away from having our set melt out from under us on every shot. So we had to be really diligent on shooting fast and shooting quickly and knowing what we were doing and people being on time. But luckily our crew was just stellar. They just kept up with me and when I was tired, they pulled me up and pushed me forward. And when I'm switching into Jason costume and then switching back out, you know, and then Brian's hopping in and we're working together. It was just like, you just can't stop to think. You just got to keep going and saying, what's the next shot on the list? What's the next thing we got to do? Because I can't lose this. And by the time we were done shooting that weekend, all the snow melted. And we were like, all right, great thing we got this. And then the next weekend it snowed again. Same thing. We were in Arrowhead. It was interior scenes and we were able to get more running around outside because of the snowing. But yeah, we shot everything. So we had a nice backdrop of snow there. And then when we went to Flagstaff the last weekend, it was luckily it had snowed in Flagstaff more. So there's a little bit more left behind, but it's by no means like plastered with snow everywhere. So it's kind of like, feels like a day, like it snowed that day. But now it's later in the day. So we had to kind of work with that and work with that as our set. But we had enough snow to say it did snow and like move things around and kind of dress the set a little bit. But yeah, it was tough. I mean, it was a big gamble. I mean, I realized how much of a big gamble it was through last season being in Southern California, not saying being in a Michigan or a Maine or, you know, or in Alaska where I know I'm going to have snow.
Right. Really, yeah.
You know,
not being airdropped in your location.
Yeah, we really, I mean, especially since we only had 6 days to shoot. And then the week after that was COVID. So even if we got a couple more weekends of snow, I couldn't go up and shoot even if I wanted to. So we had to kind of just make amends with that, but we felt lucky because we caught two storms. And so we worked them into the film and they plaster us while we're on some of our scenes. And it feels like the weather changes throughout the film. And that's just kind of life. And I mean, if everyone's ever grown up in the Northeast, that's what it's like.
Oh yeah. Now, what were some of the other technical challenges? Because, you know, you're shooting in an environment now where it's like, hey, here's our white balance at every single turn. Yeah. So what were some of the technical challenges? I mean, because obviously when you get that kind of very crisp contrast and you've got snow and you've got that action happening where, you know, you have such a distinct difference between what you're shooting and the action against that backdrop. I mean, it's a beautiful look, but it has to come with its challenges too, right?
Yeah, I mean, the light shifts. I mean, even in the movie, the light will shift mid-scene. If the sun comes out between those clouds, you know, the sun comes out between those clouds. And so luckily our DP has a very formidable arsenal of tools, including filters that basically, like, sitting in color with it, if it wasn't for those filters, there's no way we would have been able to get some of the shots to match. And so it helps us that he knows so much of what he's doing. We're shooting it on a Red Epic with an upgraded sensor. And, you know, Evan's really good at reading the meters. Our ACs are really good at reading the meters and pointing things out when we need to say, hey, you know what, we need to throw something else on there. We need to stop down or something like that. Luckily, it's not on me because I wouldn't know what the hell to do. But that's why we hire the good technical people who love to pull cameras apart. And it's like, that's what they're there for. And so I'm there to say, this looks like a pretty picture. And then they make sure technically it works. One challenge on set, I mean, what was nice was he has a body rig, and it's not really a Ronin, but it's kind of free floating handheld, but he can keep it pretty steady and we can move around pretty fast. So we're able to kind of do that. We had a set of Dana, we had a Dana dolly with rails. So it was pretty easy just to slip the rails in, slide back and forth. I mean, those push-ins on Cortland and push-in on Jason, like those are on those, and just kind of pushing and tilting and just using those moments when we needed them. And then the other thing we had, which was nice, was like a mini techno crane with a articulated head. So we used that in a few shots. We used the drone again. But yeah, using all that stuff in weather, it's electrical equipment. We had to wrap it in bags. We had to wrap the camera in a plastic bag. We had a pop-up tent out there for the ACs and everybody to get under when it was snowing like crazy and everyone's crammed under it. And it's not really like the best pop-up in the world. I mean, it's just like, just
trying. And then you got weight on top of it.
I know, they're just holding, the PAs are just holding it down. And yeah, I mean, we started, there was barely any snow on the ground. By the time we were done, there was 4 or 5 inches. And so it was plenty enough to do what we needed to do. And then the movie kind of takes off from there, and like a storm, it comes and goes, and it took somebody with it. So now it's up to everybody to find where that person went. You know what I mean? Can they save them in time? You know, Tommy's out there. Vinny, you know, I say Vinny because I always used to talk to him, but you know, Sheriff Rick Colon is out there. It's his department. This is his job, you know, and trying to figure out like what happened to this kid. And, you know, you have, you know, we have a great actress in this, Anna Campbell, who plays Diana Hill, who plays Mark Hill's mom, the missing boy. And you get to kind of live through that kind of experience with her about, you know, hearing that her son's missing and like, are they going to find him and stuff like that. So we kind of play with that session of like, this is what it's like to live in Crystal Lake. And like, you know, what happens if one day you're talking to your kid and then they don't come home? What is that experience like? So I think that's going to be something that people are going to experience while watching this film. It's one of the subtleties of, you know, we see our victims in our Friday the 13th films and we laugh and they get killed and we laugh and we don't think about the fact that like in Part 4, there's somebody in a room being told that their, you know, their brother just got their head chopped in half. You know what I mean? You can't have an open casket funeral because he's got a hard, you know, it's like because of, he's missing his jaw. So it's like, it's all this type of stuff. And it's pretty funny that, you know, we have, I think as horror fans, we always celebrate the kill. And I think in this one, we're trying to like, you know, really make somebody again, like with Kyle MacLeod, feel like they're in danger. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's something that I think, unfortunately, the franchise did suffer over a period of time, was, you know, even though we still tried to vilify Jason, or, you know, or the idea of what Camp Crystal Lake was, it became very difficult because, like you were saying too, we've seen these characters before. We get to a point where we really just want to see how they die, the inventive ways they're going to die, especially the 80s, because then we started to go to the film for the effects and we started to go, you know, for the gore. And we sort of took for granted the fact that we're getting some of these one-dimensional characters. And then we see it so many times that we start to understand that we're at a loss, you know, something's empty, something's not there anymore. And we need to get back to that, yeah. You know, especially where we're at now, because I think we're seeing a world where, and again, I hate to get socio-political, but we're seeing a world where I think we all have felt sort of dehumanized for the last couple decades. You know, we sort of feel, you know, like, McGowan's the prisoner, you know, we're just sort of a number and we don't really understand how we can get out of our own messes or our situations. And to be able to sort of take that back in and inject some personality into it, you know, I mean, you had your work cut out for you, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. But I think what's nice is that, I mean, you say that, it kind of reminds me of these characters in this story and like where they are about like they're this, you know, they're just as much like they're victims as much as they're caught up in it themselves. Like they've almost, they're in their own cycles of victimhood in almost a way. And this mini series is about people coming together to get out of it and finally dealing with something that no one's been ready to face in 30 years or willing to admit that even exists. You know, the legend of Jason, can you really prove that an undead mystical revenant is running around murdering people and making them disappear from the woods? You know, when you don't have proof, how do you convince a town to go up and burn down, you know, a camp? You know what I mean? So it's like you have this guy, Tommy Jarvis, who's like kind of become our little bit of our crazy Ralph in this world. And he's just, he knows Jason's still out there. He still feels his presence. He still feels that pull to the camp. And everyone else thinks he's nuts. And the more he shows his cards, you know, the more of an excuse they have to treat him the way they treat him. And, you know, and the people in the town who are ignorant don't know where to go. And they don't know what they're stepping into when they cross into this world. And so, like, just with Kyle MacLeod, we have, like that's kind of where these characters come from, is that it's talking about the new Crystal Lake. What happens when somebody new moves here and they don't know where to go and they don't know Crystal Lake? Yeah, maybe they were a kid when that happened and it was on the news, but they don't really remember and they forgot about it. And no one's talked about it in a long time. And Jason hasn't had and we treat it as if New Line never happened. So Jason's never had like an event since early 90s.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, things fade into the past. And I think that that's kind of part of it. And I feel like the Friday the 13th franchise itself, as we used to enjoy it, faded away somewhere in the past. And we've just been kind of, like you said, these like pity Fs, you know what I mean? Like we've just been, oh, they want another one? Well, here, have this. And you're like, why did you give us this? Space? We never asked for space. We'll take it. We'll cherish it.
It's still that pity fuck. It still is. I mean, yeah. We still get the initial excitement, you know? I mean, we still go through the motions like I'm going to shape it on a little bit of cologne. But in the end, we know exactly what it is. And then we get to see how hollow it is after the end credits roll. And we're sort of left empty again.
Right? And I think that like one of the, you know, even for as many faults as Part 8 has, at least you know that Rob Heaton, in his heart of hearts, had a vision to bring Jason to New York, and he just got swept out from under his feet at every pull.
Yeah. So
I feel like the passion for telling Jason's stories were there. You know, even John Carl Buechler with like really being like kind of paying attention to the damage and like trying to tell it as an original story. But then the excitement really that Tom McLaughlin brought to it, Part 6, I think was something in that, like, it felt like a good ending. Tommy got, you know, beat Jason again, and the death for Jason was really cool at the end of that, and the final sequences were good. And then it was kind of after that, the final sequences started to unravel a little bit. And we haven't really, like, as crazy as Jason Goes to Hell is, it does have a cool ending, but it's still like, I don't know if that's how Jason would go. Magical sister that shows up after all this time. I don't know if I really want this Michael Myers all of a sudden thing. And it wasn't.
Well, that's why you see, like, Mustafa Akkad's back there, ring in his hands.
Yeah, and so
that's how that happens.
And then you have, you know, then Jason actually gets sucked out into space. Woo-woo. You know, Freddy versus Jason, you know, that's just a one-off battle film. And then in 2009, yeah. It was like five endings in one. They couldn't pick one, so they made them all. And, you know, so it hasn't felt like anything's had that real, like, stick in the landing since part six. And I feel like I wanted to pick up from that excitement and be like, all right, let's build something and then stick a landing again and then say, all right, this is all I have to say about Friday the 13th and move on with my life. I didn't think I would get a chance to do that, but since I've been given the opportunity, I'm kind of just like, if this is the ball and you guys are handing it and you guys are okay with it, then I will run with it.
Well, one thing that we see in Friday the 13th films, especially through the earlier canon films, even we had some of the same creative parties that were getting together for the sequels, there was always sort of this initiative to, you know, here's my personal imprint that I'm going to leave upon it. Yeah. You know, I'm going to change Jason up a little bit. We're going to do something with him visually. We've got a different design perspective with Jason this time around. Okay. So being a person that's now been able to revisit the character, did you come into it with, you know, we had something solid with Never Hike Alone. You know, Ghost Jason is, you know, now this design that seems to resonate. We're going to keep it. Or what was the agenda as far as the design of approaching Jason in this the second installment?
I mean, originally trying to just keep it short, it was that we wanted to treat it as if Jason's old costume and his mask were destroyed at the end of Part 8. I mean, multiple masks were destroyed through the series, but him coming back, by the time he came back to Crystal Lake after that event, he was basically stripped to nothing. I mean, you can imagine all that toxic waste would have melted his clothes and whatever. The skin would have damaged him even more. He would have been really weak. And I feel like he's slowly built himself over time. And looking at the modern costume, I always felt that it was never quite right. Like Freddy versus Jason was just too ragtag. He was like so bulky and big and hobo-y, yeah. Like vagrant-y. And then then 2009 was really like over the top Michael Bay, like look at my cool jacket and utility belt and all this stuff. And like, yeah, I was kind of like, a little bit too far. I don't like the stringy hair.
It was G.I. Jason, you know.
Yeah, so I tried to do something that was like, if you took Jason's original like look from part four, green shirt, brown pants.
Yeah.
Boom, start there. But let's make it a jacket. So there's your jacket, but it fits like an open Sears work shirt, and just put a gray shirt underneath it. Gray skin tone. He matches the forest now. Very easy. And so as we're moving forward in Never Hike Alone, I don't want to change the look too much. Like the only thing we've done is just made things fit better and get better appliances. Mm. So we swapped out the hands for this movie. Like we had like, I can't remember the name of the other one, but now we go with zombie hands to CFX. We have them painted a very specific color gray that we work with them on. So the appliances stay the same. We just really adjusted and said, okay, these things have to match and be the same thing. With our clothing, we just got it tailored a little bit better so it wasn't so tight in some places. I know everyone called him Hipster Jason for a little bit. But, you know, we worked on kind of like, all right, the pants should hang a little bit more and be a little bit more baggy. And kind of having to replace things. And
isn't it great that no matter what you do,
yeah. There's always something. Pants are a little tight. I like they say that, like, oh, this Jason looks small. In the costume, I'm 6'5". Like, when I wear those boots, it jacks me up like an inch and a half.
Yeah. But you're supposed to be like 8 foot tall. That's it.
So, I know. Well, I mean, hey, whatever. They can be about it all they want. But Jason's
the pants
not
take like, off 2 inches.
Yeah, really. But I mean, yeah. It's like, I mean, I'm standing on ground level. I'm 6'3", 225. It's not a bad size. Yeah. I put all the costume stuff on and I look like I'm 240, 6'5". So I think that that's a good size for Jason. There's enough lankiness. There's enough build to say that he could be powerful, but he's also a decaying monster. So he's not necessarily building muscle. He's losing and getting emaciated over time more than anything.
Right.
That us playing into that level would be if we say shred his clothing as the movies go on, like we want to, and we can afford that, then you're going to see that like part seven-ish of him, of rib cages showing through and pieces of him coming apart, which will be really cool. And you'll see that like, he's really kind of just stitched together after all these years. And the curse is just the only thing keeping him moving, really. So, I mean, it was really that. And so for us, it's more about, as long as it looks good on camera and it stays the same production design wise, Ghost Jason will stay the same. This is our look. We lucked into creating something really cool and iconic with, I think, what we've done, and we're sticking to it. And that will be our little, it'll be what we leave behind, and it'll be cool to see people cosplaying it like they do, and we're really like proud to see that.
So I know it's got to be difficult because this is sort of a predictive question, but you do have some kind of a timeline in mind, right, for some of the future installments. As loose as it might be, what really is your plan at this point?
No, I mean, I have it all figured out. Like, I can sit down and pitch anybody through every scene all the way to the end of this movie, act out every part. Like, I got it down that much. And I've written the next two episodes, and the last one's kind of outlined because there's some very big technical VFX challenges in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of got to sit down and really hash that one out. But because we split it up into three, I've now really kind of focused down on each one. I make one at a time, focus on the production for that, the sets that we need to get kind of like that. But if this worked the way I would want it to, we would run another Indiegogo next spring for Never Hike Again. We'd be able to produce that over the summer, have it in the fall, have another one that's ready to go for Jason Takes Crystal Lake. We do that in the spring of 2020. Two, I guess, at that point, and kind of produce that. And that one's a big one, so that will take all summer, and we'll have to raise a lot more money. The only other options are fans don't want to wait. We can rally 5,000 to 10,000 Friday the 13th fans to pay to give us in between $5 and $20, and we raise $500,000 or we raise $600,000, and we legitimately produce this movie, which is going to need all those things. And the only
right.
reason I'm not being too kind of open about what we want to do is I want to hold back surprises, but these are for locations and multiple kills and vehicles and going to a hospital. I mean, a majority of the film takes place in a hospital. And so we have to kind of break out the days of how many days do we need to be on a hospital set? How many days do we need to shoot an exterior of a hospital set?
Mm-hmm.
And we destroy some stuff in the hospital. And how much does that cost? And how much are some of these stunts going to cost? Because we want to
yeah.
wire work, and we want to do explosions, and we want to do driving stunts, you know, things that require us. We can't just go out and shoot those in our backyard. And we know it starts to kind of shade, really blurs the line on like, wait, these are supposed to be fun films you do in your backyard, not like professional productions. But if we're being afforded the opportunity and we're putting it into it, we'll take it as far as we can until someone tells us to stop or the studios finally say, all right, enough, we'll give you the money. Like, we'll do this with you. And I would really think that in the hierarchy of where the Never Hike Alone stuff goes,
yeah.
I honestly think it would be the perfect thing for a streaming series, a streaming mini series, just like the way we've broken it up now. I mean, you can take it to the theater if you want, but I think Friday the 13th, part 13 has to be its own original thing. It has to fit however it wants to fit. If they wanted me to remake Never Hike Alone for it, I would not bat down that opportunity to go back and make it on a bigger stage with a bigger budget and, you know, 90 minutes long. I don't know if I could capture the tone of the first one. It'd be kind of hard to just like make it all happen again. I'd like to do something fresh. That's why I want to do this. And I think it belongs in this world. But I think that that's where we could fit in for the studios if they wanted to take it. And that we could go to a Shudder, or we could go to a Hulu or a Netflix, like a Love Death Robots did, for just, hey, here's like a grab bag of horror, weird sci-fi animated shorts. I was like, well, what if we were like this little grab bag of Friday the 13th episodes, and like that it just came out and people could watch it, stream it back and forth, and get Blu-rays if they want. They want Ghost Jason dolls, do that too. But like, legitimize it so we can finish our story, because that's ultimately all I'm trying to do, is just get this story out of me. And I think any director or storyteller knows that when they get that story in them, it's like hell. It's like it lives inside them. You're like, just get out, like just be real. And that's kind of the nice thing about Never Hike Alone and Never Hike in the Snow, is that they were those things in me at one time. And to see them kind of like up and moving around and being something, and they formed in my head, you know, which were doodles on a note card that I would scan and send to a concept artist. It was a scribble, like 5-year-old drawing it. And then all of a sudden it's like done by an artist. We have something in the concept, and then it's happening on screen. It's happening. And so I just want to keep going, because I think if fans continually like what they see, that the pictures only get crazier and the situations only get even more tense and the story unfolds even more and that's kind of the nice gem of this, is that through this story a bunch of characters really come together and heal past wounds and kind of overcome not only just Jason but things that else that are going on in their lives that help them kind of get to closure and, you know, bring this tale in the series to a close. I don't think you can ever really kill Jason, but I think obviously we need to bring it to an end. They need it, and someone at some point needs to take Jason down. You know, we want to build towards one of those conclusions. Like at the end of part six, you go, okay, Jason might have lost, but that was a good, that was a, I tip my cap to Tommy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Not one of those. And, or you feel like the character who is killing them, like a Chris or a Jenny or even a young Tommy, you feel like, yeah, that's the character that's earned it. Or Alice taken out, you know, Mrs. Voorhees, she finally survived and survived all those attacks and defended herself. It's like, we want to get it to that point. And so we're building up Jason, who's like wavered in our world as far as like how sympathetic characters are going to be towards him.
Right.
And we're going to play with that. But eventually he's going to be that Jason that's just nonstop killing machine, and he has to be put down, and there's no stopping him. It's like there's maybe some humanity left in there, but it's about, whatever's left is about to be sucked out of him pretty, pretty hard.
Well, we have to also look at this from a perspective of, if you can create a character that people can rally enough behind so that you can take that icon down and take it with cheers and not jeers, then you've done a good job, because at this point, all we've really been able to do is create one character that you could get behind. And we've been behind him for a very long time. So the ability of being able to create that antipode is... I mean, that's a measure of success. There's a pretty good barometer right there, I think. And I think it Never Hike Alone had that.
Yeah, I think Kyle earned that. I think at the end of the movie, he earned it. And what was nice was, even as much as he defeated Jason for a moment, it was a it was a Mexican standoff. It was, they kind of got each other. But he put him down just long enough so he could get away. But the greatest thing about Jason is, it's, you might be able to stop him, but you can only slow him down. And that's it. It might take long. It might take 30 years for him to come back. But eventually, the train's going to get enough steam again. And I think that Never Hike in the Snow is a little bit of this train starting to pick up steam. And you see how much power is in it. And it's like, don't poke this bear.
Yeah.
Like, this is the bear you don't want to wake up from hibernation. And so when we pick up in Never Hike again, we're kind of continuing this storyline a little bit. And Rick and Tommy in that movie, that episode, have a very specific conversation about this kind of dynamic, about how the town feels about the camp, about what to do and what not to do. Like, what not to do is go into the camp and provoke the bear. Don't go there. Don't look for things. Don't do stuff. And the other person was like, well, eventually that bear is coming out. And if we don't go to it, it's coming to us, and we're not going to be ready. So one of us is wrong. And we'll see who that is. And what we know already from our story, because everyone's seen the first movie, is that the thing that changes the world is Kyle MacLeod, the person who goes into Crystal Lake and actually escapes and brings Jason with him. And so because he's the one who gets away, unlike our characters and disappear, the ones who go in and they get killed up right away. And nobody ever finds their bodies. Nobody ever even goes looking for them. You know, in my world, when somebody goes missing in Crystal Lake, they'll search everywhere but the camp. It's like its own kind of like, oh, we don't have to go there because that's off limits. And if you're out there, then you're out there and you won't be found. But we won't find anything out there. They purposefully avoid that place type thing.
Yeah, if they're going to be found, here's where they're not going to be found.
Yeah, here's where they're not going to be found or where we're not going. Or like, can you imagine, like, I always wanted to do these like little mini episodes of the deputy who's always in charge of like, well, you have to go search Crystal Lake. And he pulls up the gate. And he looks out down this thing and he goes, I didn't see nothing, and just keeps driving because they're just too scared to go in, you know, that type of thing. And I think that that's what I wanted to create with this Crystal Lake, is that people in this town who do know what it is and do know what is in the Wessex County Wildlife Preservation, they're scared to shit of it. And they know not to go anywhere near it. They're lucky that they haven't had to deal with it, so they might have like forgot it was there. But if you reminded them of what was there or asked them to go down that path, you couldn't pay anyone in that town enough money. And they couldn't explain to you why, because they didn't want you to look at you with five heads. They just know, I'm going to stay out of there, and it's best that you do too. And that's all they're ever going to tell you.
And that's an interesting part of the the story, and I think the lexicon of these smaller stories that attach themselves to something that we don't get to see that often, mm-hmm. is the fact that the curse of Cramped Crystal Lake extends far beyond Crystal Lake.
Yeah.
But we don't get to see it that often. So I like the fact that you're going there and you're showing us some of these things, because that history does not die. You know, no matter how many brooms you were out trying to, you know, brush it under the carpet, you know, you peel back the carpet and you're like, holy shit, there's a fruit cellar under here. That dirt has got to have gone somewhere.
Yeah, and I think that in this town, I think in our world of Crystal Lake, that the problems in this area have existed far beyond there was ever a camp. You know, I think we go back to like the Badlands comic in the way that it just seems to bring out the worst in people. And I can imagine that in 1957, when those two kids died and Jason went missing, that wasn't the first time there was an incident in Crystal Lake. It was just the last time for a long time. And
yeah.
And they tried to reopen that camp, but because they were so focused on trying to reopen that camp in 62 and 67 and 1980, in my head, Steve Christie is the last surviving Christie. All these bad things happen to his relatives, and he probably all ties it back to these events, which I can only imagine as a good writer trying to put something together in the future, that Steve Christie must have been the counselor responsible for Jason's death, and he was the one that was supposed to be watching. So you can imagine him coming back in 1980 with all that guilt, trying to open that back up, being this
oh, yeah.
is my family. Only realizing that the camp pulled him back, only to pull Jason, Mrs. Voorhees back too, and be like, ha ha, got y'all, motherfuckers. Like, that's just the way the camp works. It's just like The Shining. It's just like any Derry, Maine. It's got that type of feel to it. And I think that that brings out the supernatural power of Crystal Lake and makes this whole story, even though it's not logical, real world sense, it's entertainment supernatural sense, and something we can go, oh, I get that. It's just like saying a ghost in The Conjuring is a spirit with unfinished business. Okay, that's the rule, then let's play by that rule. And I think if Crystal Lake and Friday the 13th set itself up in that dynamic across its entire board, it kind of like makes the entire series make more sense. You start to go, okay, I understand the bounds of reality have been stretched already, but here's kind of the fabric of it, and here's how it kind of works. And it's not that Never Hike Again or Never Hike in the Snow or any of these films are really diving into, like, here are the mechanics of the way the curse worked. And, like, as much as I would love to do a whole biopic on, like, here's how fucked up Crystal Lake is all the way from 1700 to, you know, present day, that's a lot of money and a lot of wasted time. I'm just going to tell the story. But I think
it would be contested anyways.
Yeah, but I think if the fans watch it, they'll pick up on the subtleties and they'll see where, like, even there's a couple specific things in Never Hike in the Snow that, like, I can't wait for people to see it, because afterwards we're going to have some really great conversations. And when people really find out, like, what my intentions are with some of the things, I think that they too are now going to be like, oh shit, this is like complex. Like, this has, like, this is like a nice robust wine here. It's not like two buck chuck that you got and like pounded back in the 80s. Like, this is something that's matured, and these characters are matured, and Jason has matured, and he's more complex, but not in a way that makes you say, like, Jason sitting there reading a thesaurus being like, how I ponder my existence in which today. It's just that you can see that, like, the circuits aren't always firing as a drone. You know what I mean? Like, there's something like,
right.
What the fuck is going on with me? Like, what am I? And then being like, well, it doesn't matter because this is my job, and back into service for the camp. And to see kind of Jason in vulnerable ways too, that I think kind of show them like what he is really underneath all this, like, evil and like giantness, like, what is Jason? And I think it's kind of, it should be key for audiences to remember what he is and why he does what he does and what kicked all of this off in the first place for this specific storyline in Crystal Lake. And then as we tell this story, how everyone else has been pulled into it too. And it's just this black hole of emptiness for everybody who gets involved, and everyone's trying to escape it. And it's going to be whether or not these characters can escape this curse by having to take essentially Jason head on. And so it's going to be which one ends up on top of all these characters kind of in town. And, you know, not all of them are going to make it. But the ones that do, I think they can find, you'll see in the resolutions how they're finally able to let go and move on.
So we're not going to get Smoking Jacket Jason just yet.
No.
We don't have that.
No. We're not going to get Professor Jason.
Not the sophisticated Jason.
No, it's like the, he had the hawk with like the glasses built in, the bifocals.
I'll see, that would be great. I mean, he's got like a really old copy of like People magazine with the crosswords in it. You know, he could be sitting doing that, feet kicked up on a stump. I think it's perfect.
It's just, it fills the whole thing. It would just kill and mother. Kill, mother.
Right. but he feels very accomplished at the end of it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, what happens to a being that sits around in an attic for 30 years? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I mean, Jason built that shack in 5 years. You know what I mean? Like, so if that's what happened back then, it's like, what happened now? But it's cool that we have these sets that we get to play in. Like, we have three sets now. We have our original Camp Crystal Lake set in Angeles Oaks. We moved down the street for this one for a couple of shots just to house our crew and shoot around there just to get some backdrops of camp. There, and then we have one in Flagstaff. But everywhere we shoot, these camps were built in the 30s. So they all have that aesthetic. And there was one that had some like updates, like maybe in the 80s. So it gives a little bit like, oh, this is the part that they were working on, which is kind of cool. So there's different.
Right, yeah.
You can see how, like, I always want to make it feel like this isn't a camp that's complete. This is a camp that was in the middle of being built. So there's stuff left around. There's tools on the floor. There's still things where, like, paint is sitting, like, they were going to paint this wall the next day and they never got to it. But it stayed there for 40 years type of thing. But also, Jason has gone through this camp and picked things that he's needed to kind of rebuild his life, to rebuild what it was like when he was a kid almost. You know, like, if I can recreate the room the way mom had it, maybe this won't be so bad. You know, like, and seeing him make decisions like that, it's like, as much as he kills people, to see a character make a decision like that, it's like, are they all evil? Like, is it really who they are at the core? Was Jason Voorhees as a little boy a little murderer? I don't think so. Like, he grew into that. He was forced into that. He was pulled from the death into it. He's, you know, he was just a kid who drowned. And then his mother went nuts, probably because of the curse in some way. And now he's brought back as like a proponent of the actual living embodiment of the curse. And now it's his job to do what his mother did and keep killing people and keep collecting people for the lake. And then, but really, like, is this the job he's wanted? You know, is this the job that he dresses for? Is this what he wanted to grow up to be as a kid? So I think that, you know, we got to ask that question. And I know it's not the first thing you'd say when you sit down on a board meeting at Friday the 13th in Paramount in 1983. And we're like, what does Jason really think?
What is Jason's motivation?
I would have been fired out to the board. But this is a fan film, and I can ask those questions. And out of those questions come really interesting scenes that aren't just dialogue scenes of people explaining to you, okay, this is my theory, and now let me put it in a friggin' long-ass, like, monologue that you're going to listen to people talk about it. You're just going to see things in action. It's like, if this is the way it is, this is how things work. And these are the choices that people will make and while they make these choices. And so I think that since we give a little bit more context to the choices the characters make in these films, it just expands Friday the 13th out a little bit more. It now gives it more breathing room to tell different stories, rather than having to come up with, like, okay, what's another reason kids are coming to town this weekend? Like, okay, it's this now, you know what I mean? And now they're in a different house. And then, you know, how does this one go outside? Okay, now one of them's got to pee and go outside. It's like, it's always the same thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, let's give them something a little bit different that has different twists and turns, but eventually gets you to those kill sequences that you like and sets up the Jason stuff and makes cool Jason shots that you want to see and make him look big and iconic on screen. Like, those are the things we're trying to do, is tell a good story, but also, like, give you some iconic, like, memorable Jason moments that when you think about the film, you think about all the emotional stuff, really what you're going to be thinking about is like, man, that was cool when Jason fired that arrow. You see the way he stepped out, he pulled back the thing and the shot, the way it was focused. Like, that's what people are going to talk about. And we understand that that's what they're there for. That's what they're there to chew on. But in the meantime, in between, we're gonna spoon feed them some nice, like, juicy story and emotion, and they might start to feel differently about certain characters along the course of the film. And then by the time it ends, we just want to leave them wanting more. And I think that's the biggest note I keep getting. It's just like, oh my God, because it's 25 minutes, they're like, that's amazing. I just want more. How do I get more? And I'm like, well, it's coming. And it's like, these are the steps we're taking. This is the first step. Next step is Never Hike Again. And we've already shown that we can raise the money for Never Hike Again. That last campaign would more than cover Never Hike Again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we just got to aim for that again. And so if we can do that and grow our fan base, then we can make that next installment. And we can actually put the piece together that finishes Never Hike Alone, really. The why did Tommy find how and why did Tommy find Kyle? What drew him out there? Which is an answer that's pretty simpler than you think. But before he gets out there, who's Tommy Jarvis in 2017 or 2020, wherever we're setting this world? What has he been doing for 30 years? Like, what has he really been doing? Why did he become an EMT? You know, what is his day like? Is he still haunted by the curse? And what does that look like? And so when you get a glimpse into the day of like how Tommy's life has been for 30 years and how it's kind of fallen apart and how he's his own worst enemy, that all of a sudden the situation that he's been waiting for is going to be thrust upon him. And now he has to go into action. And how is he going to react? And ultimately this is the oh shit moment for, you know, for Tommy, where he's like, oh, he's been saying, you know, the sky is falling for 30 years, and now the sky has actually fallen right into his lap. And so with this moment and Jason standing right in front of him, what is the choice that Tommy's going to make when he's driving away in that ambulance? Do you think he's driving away all the way back to town, or do you think he's going to stand and fight at some point and realize that he's the only person he can do it? So we got a little bit more of that to tell, which is like a really great face-off between Tommy and Jason, which will then launch us into the next chapter, which is Jason Takes Crystal Lake, which I think really, other than parts 2, 3, and 4, this is the first time we're going to see Jason travel into town and bring all that havoc with him. And almost like Michael Myers in Halloween 2, traveling through Haddonfield, or even in 2018, traveling through Haddonfield, murdering everybody on the way to where he's trying to get to. We're doing the same thing in that. And then his final destination is a hospital. So we're taking, you know, Friday the 13th, the final chapter in Halloween 2, and putting Ghost Jason in that situation, with Andrew being our Laurie Strode, stuck in a hospital bed trying to recover from surgery, Tommy trying to get answers out of him to figure out what the fuck is going on, and then some other characters who are like, what is wrong with all you people? Where are Axel and Denny? The cops are here. Like, what are we going to do? And then all of a sudden, right, like, you know, the chaos of like chaos brewing in Crystal Lake, and then Jason showing up in the middle of town and everyone going, what the hell? And having this moment. And I think that there are moments in Friday the 13th we've always thought about as fans, but we've never seen or have ever seen them realized on screen. And I think, you know, the 2017 or the 2016 version that David Bruckner and Nick Acosta had a version of that at the end of the script, which is really, really cool. So it was kind of one of those things when I read that script and I saw like some, parallel thoughts, I was like, I'm on the right path. If someone like David Bruckner or Nick Acosta were on this path, I'm on the right path. I'm definitely keeping this as an element in the film now, because that's an opportunity we missed. So let's create it now. So it's, I think that's going to be really cool. And it's kind of, and that's its own kind of ending in town, but that's not the end of the story, because in order to complete the destruction of the curse, we got to go back to Crystal Lake. So that's why the last one's called The Final Hike, because our surviving characters from Jason Takes Crystal Lake now have to go back to Camp Crystal Lake and put Jason to rest once and for all. And so it's, you know, who's going to survive, who's going to go on that journey, and how are those characters going to work together to solve this little puzzle that Tommy's been trying to solve for 30 years and doesn't have the missing piece. But it just so happens the person who has the missing piece is Kyle MacLeod. He just doesn't know it because he's too much of a dummy. And that's kind of the fun part. He's the innocent kind of,
yeah,
you know, he's the comic relief in a way. But he's our Luke Skywalker and Tommy's our Obi-Wan Kenobi, or, you know, if you want to think about it that way. And our, you know, this character that we're introducing in this first film, Diana Hill, the mother of Mark Hill, is a little bit of our Princess Leia, where she's got a stake involved too, eventually, as this goes on. And so she works at that hospital. She's a doctor at the hospital, and she's the one who's going to treat Tommy and Kyle when they come in. So she's going to get stuck between a bunch of different worlds because her, her priorities lie like with real world. You know what I mean? Like, how do I know these guys aren't lying to me? How do they know they don't have something to do with, you know, other things in my past? Or, you know, what happens when the cops come in and they don't really think Jason exists and they think Tommy's doing everything? So there's like, there's all these obstacles for our characters to solve the real issues that kind of help compound the action and get different storylines going to where, like, it's not an A to B story. It's like they want to get A to B, but there's too many things in their path to make it simple. And because those things get in their way, it just makes it harder for everyone else. And Jason gets to kill that many more people.
Well, the way you've described it, Vincent, this could be episodic with more than just the episodes that you've got laid out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there really is a sense here of a seasonal story, something that takes place over 15 to 20 episodes. An additional 15 to 20 episodes.
It'd be nice if I could make the story last. I mean, I know where I want to take it to after the Never Hike Alone section of it. I have two episodes that I've already thought about, actually three episodes that I've already thought about that I would like to add, which could add as prequel episodes again. One specifically just about Pamela. Another one would be about Jason escaping New York, which I think would be really cool. And then this story about how Jason kind of came to be Ghost Jason and what was his transformation from the being that escaped New York to the being that arrived in Crystal Lake and who was waiting for them and what happened in his absence. Because in his absence, I have this story about war veteran who has now moved into the camp and started squatting there and creating a little life for himself and not realizing that, like, Jason is coming home. And then Jason watching this guy and sizing him up until one day they're going to face off and having this kind of battle over this territory where this guy doesn't know whether or not he's actually fighting an undead being or he's fighting enemies from his PTSD past. So it's kind of a cool, like, different way you can use Jason. And Jason wouldn't look the same. He wouldn't have a hockey mask. It would be our version of the hood.
Right.
He would probably be covered in more sheets, kind of like a ghost, because he doesn't have any clothes to cover himself because they all got melted off. So he's pulled down the drapery that's on the windows and wrapped himself in it like a mummy and pulled it over his face to hide his appearance and blend into the background and stuff and watch this guy. And this guy having these encounters with him but not knowing whether or not he's having a psychotic break or Jason's really there. And then at the end of it, it's really about Jason taking his clothing T-800 style. Where this is the guy who's wearing the green military jacket and the gray shirt and the brown pants and the military boots. And slowly but surely, Jason pulls these things off and dresses himself with the things that are from the camp and that final piece of finding the mask and putting it on and becoming Jason again and reestablishing his home and, you know, becoming the dominating force that lives at Crystal Lake. And I think it's also going to allow us to let Crystal Lake itself, that supernatural entity that exists outside of Jason, to also mess with this character. So not only is Jason messing with him and being kind of that force, but because it's not powerful enough, the camp having to kind of spread itself out and extend its reach and show its true nature. And I think that that's something that's cool to explore within a storytelling aspect. And it makes it less of a, you know, a body count film without a slasher and more about a place, a time, a, you know, something bigger than ourselves, which I think adds to an awe of a story and adds to the awe of Friday the 13th. And maybe it could be its own original story, but I love Jason so much, I think he deserves it. I've always just wanted to see Jason treated a little bit better than he has been, especially in the last 20 years. So this is just me saying, this is the film I've always wanted to see. And if I ever had the opportunity, this is how I do it. And we can tell stories about Jason. We can tell stories about people in town. I can tell stories about, you know, the 1600s and the pioneers who were trying to settle that area and dealing with the native population, but nobody wanted to go near this area and dealing with stuff that could happen then. So there's a lot that can be told about this place if studios just invest in Crystal Lake, because the one thing that we know on the opposite end of that is that the fans will be there to eat it up. You know, what's the risk of one series? What's the risk of one episode? What's the risk of all this stuff to at least see that it's there? Because at least, you know, it will be reciprocated enough. And you haven't done anything in 12 years, so they're going to eat it all up.
The longevity has been proven. And it's been proven to a lesser and greater degree, depending on the subject, with the fan films, too. Which I know you have sort of a love-hate relationship with fan films.
I mean, I don't really have a love-hate. It's more about kind of the different stances that a fan film should take, because it all comes down to one specific thing, and that is responsibility and who you're responsible to. So if you're doing this fan film with no money, you know, kind of like Rene Rivas, who did Spirit of Haddonfield, it was all out of pocket. I think maybe he spent $200 on, like, getting a piece that he needed for his camera, but everything else he owned was part of his, you know, he owned that costume. they gave them the house as a favor. Everyone volunteered to work, and we put that together, and we had fun. We owed nothing to nobody other than ourselves to make it, and that was a really fun feeling, and there was no pressure other than to impress ourselves. Anytime a film steps into the world of asking for crowdfunding, you've got a lot of legal things you've got to look out for.
Yeah.
But more than anything, more than the studios being upset that you're playing with their characters or, you know, whether or not how you represent yourself, the most important thing is the fact that someone who has to go to a job and earn a paycheck is going to take a part of that paycheck and give you a piece of it to go make something. So if you're going to take that responsibility, you better come back with something for them to watch in some point. Whether it takes you 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, I don't care. Talk to those people and communicate with them, make them know and understand what is going on with their investment, and don't take that for granted, because it's an opportunity not a lot of people get. And there are a lot of independent filmmakers out there, especially who raise money on Indiegogo, have trouble. I mean, I've had trouble raising, you know, money for original projects before.
Yeah.
And you know, fan films come along because they have a built-in fan base. People run to them no matter the skill level of the filmmaker sometimes, and it can feel like people are being kind of cheated out of cash. Unfortunately, the truth is, and since I've done it both ways, it's just that those people who are funding the Friday the 13th and Halloween and Texas Chainsaw fan films, that's the only thing they're funding. They're not funding any independent stuff. And it's
right.
But the way we can get them to do that is see that independent filmmakers can make stuff that's really good and then convince them to start investing in a little bit more of our original stuff. And as they get to know us more, when we do our, you know, a rising tide raises all ships. So it's the more independent filmmakers can get known. And then if we're going out on the road and we're going to different film festivals and different conventions, drawing people there, we want them to meet our friends. We want them to meet our other fellow filmmakers who are out there making stuff, grinding on the independent circuit, who we've seen out there for the last 3 years, schlepping around the country.
Yeah.
Films, talking about them, engaging with as many people as they can so they can take the next steps in their career. So the next film that they make isn't made for $5,000, it's made for $50,000 or $500,000. And so we want to give give these independent filmmakers as much opportunity as possible to tell the stories that are going to wow us. It's really tough to do that when we have no money. You know, it's really tough to really do those surprises unless you have some crazy skill that you can film. Whether you're a VFX artist on practical or digital, mm-hmm. You know, if you have music that you can do or something like that, if you have something you can center it around, you might have an avenue. But for a lot of us filmmakers, we want to do things. We want to show things off. We want to hire a stunt department, or we want to get the light rights, or we want to shoot at the right locations, create that feeling that when you step into our movies, you've been transported to another world. Another time, someplace that's familiar but different enough for you to escape for a half hour, an hour, 90 minutes. And so we need support. And so I feel like fan films can be divisive, but ultimately I think it shows that they're coming from independent places. And what we're trying to do is get more people interested in it, and then trying to do the best we can, knowing that we're getting more eyes on us to say, look at our original projects, look at these other original projects, these are our friends. You know, keep supporting. And so I think that...
And that enthusiasm can be systemic.
Yeah, and it is. And I think that, you know, it's our class. You know, this is the horror class of this generation who are working their way through the indie circuit right now. We're all earning our stripes in whatever way, shape, or form we can. I never would have told, if you would have told me in 2008 when I moved to LA that I would become most successful after making a Friday the 13th fan film, I would have laughed. I would have been like, no way. That would only be like a dream come true. And so I didn't predict this. You know what I mean? Like, I want to make movies, and I have that opportunity. It's just that I also have this opportunity, and I'm doing both at the same time. And I think if anyone kind of delves deep into my past or figures out what I'm working on every day, they know that I'm working on sets or I'm building my own, you know, original feature right now behind all of this stuff. And I have original projects that are in production that, you know, I just produced a film called Pathosis that was directed by my good friend Austin Boning that just won Best Horror Short at Genre Blast this weekend. So Womp Stomp Films, even though we got our start in fan film, and we're expanding to the original world and finding success, we want to continue that success. Our next project is called Ghost Chicken, and it's about a vegan restaurant that's haunted by a ghost chicken. It's a little supernatural horror comedy. It's about probably 15 minutes, and it's going to be our first ever attempt at animating a film. So we've hired a storyboard artist, we're gonna go find animators, and we're gonna build it in the time of COVID so none of us have to be in the same room together to make it. And we're going to take that out next year, but we got to ask fans to crowdfund that. But I don't think we get Ghost Chicken crowdfunded without the success of Never Hike Alone, without the success of Pathosis, without the success of Never Hike in the Snow. It's a building. It's a lot of different steps. And in 10 years from now, I shouldn't have to be making fan films. You know what I mean? I should just be either making the films or making original films. And that's my goal. This is a short 5-year window, and I'm trying to perfect what is making me kind of like stand out in the scene. And then once I've completed this journey, I will move on to the next thing. But I still feel like I'm in the middle of it.
And you're still doing what you love. You're doing it with enthusiasm and passion, and it shows. And I think that that's sort of what I was talking about with this idea of a love-hate relationship, is that you love the idea of fan films. You love the idea of being able to have a conduit to channel that. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, there are these negative underpinnings that unfortunately end up hurting it, you know, and hurting the filmmakers, because there are some poor examples out there of people who do take their hard-earned money, people who are working minimum wage but are horror fans, sinking into a project that never comes to light and it never sees fruition.
That is a risk for crowdfunding, no matter what venture, you know, whether you're funding a movie or a keychain that's going to help you open doors. COVID. Whatever it is, there's never a guarantee, and that's the warning you get anytime you do. And I have to answer the email saying, what do you mean I might not get something? And I always have to say, sometimes it doesn't work. But look back at our body of work. Every single campaign we've done, everybody has received what they've either received what they're supposed to get, or if somehow UPS or USPS or FedEx couldn't get them a package wherever they were, they got a refund. So, you know, but most of the time people are just happy to get the movie. And that will happen. And yeah, you don't want the people out there who are, you know, I think everyone gets into it with the best intention. It's just a pre-warning to people to be like, get ready. It's a lot of work. It's not as simple as it looks.
And I would never tell an aspiring filmmaker not to be a filmmaker, not to strive to make a film. If they've got a story that they want to tell, by all means, tell it. But I would also tell that same person, research as much as possible going into this so that you can successfully make it, so that you can set this up so that there's film number two and film number three, so that you're finding an audience and you're satisfying the expectations of the audience, you know, instead of, unfortunately, shedding a negative light on a lot of other indie filmmakers, simply because it's easy to get lumped into a group.
Yeah.
We know that as far as finding funding, it's easy to get lumped into a group of somebody who was given $500,000 in a film that never got made.
I mean, so the question is, it's like, how do you stand out? Like, how do you make yourself stand out? And ultimately, like, you know, I've spent the last 2 years trying to convince people of Never Hike in the Snow, or like, and a lot of people love it, but there's, you know, even the fan film side of it, they're kind of like, everyone still cocks their head, even with all the success of Never Hike Alone. And even they say like, oh, well, they made a fan film, blah, 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 blah. And I get it. And I accept that. And that's part of what the good and bad of everything. It's like, not everything that happened because Never Hike Alone is great. I still have to explain myself as, no, I still make original stuff too. Like, go watch my original stuff. It's just that I don't know, it's all good. Like, I'm proud of both work that I do, and I'm very proud of the story I told in Never Hike Alone and the one I'm telling in Never Hike in the Snow. But when I can go out and I can show the trailer I did last week, and I can say, this is what we did. This is what happens when we're funded. This is what happens when, you know, we have it from day one, everything that we need. This is the level of quality you're going to get from us. And that's a step up from what it was 3 years ago. You know, we're better than we were 3 years ago, and imagine where we're going to be in 3 years from now. So get on this train and support us now and help us get to 3 years from now. And this is part of that journey. And we are super passionate about it. I'm super passionate about Friday the 13th. I've been talking about Friday the 13th my entire life. When Never Hike Alone hit, I remember I was sitting with my brothers. We actually went up to the camp where we made the movie, and we camped there overnight. It's kind of like a celebratory thing. And they just laughed at me because they were like, we should have guessed that something like this would happen. You've just been talking about Friday the 13th your entire life. Like, you would be the guy who actually got a fan film that people would watch. And it was just, and it felt right. I mean, this whole thing, as crazy as it is, even if somebody on the outside, if I would have said like, fan films, whatever, like, I don't know how to explain it other than every time I focus my effort on working on this stuff, I feel like I'm in the right place. I feel like stars are aligning, things are happening that I'd even asked to happen, and they're just appearing in front of me. And I can't ask for I can't believe the opportunities that come up because of this stuff. And so who am I to question that? And as long as no one has a problem with it from the actual people who own it, if fans have a problem, I'm sorry, but like, If the guy who owns it doesn't care, why should you? And the only thing you should be really worried about is, hey, I spent my entire last 2 years, instead of going on vacations and, you know, seeing my family more often and doing these things, I spent time talking to people like you. I spent time with other fans at conventions, sitting at a table, having long conversations about Friday the 13th, horror in general, the things we want to see. And I'm calculating it all and trying to create content for you. And I have something for you on October 13th. So you can be mad that I spent all my time doing that, or you could just be happy that there's something new, because if it wasn't for me and other fan filmmakers who have stuff coming out after me, you would have nothing. You have nothing to talk about. And even if the theories and the things we do are crazy, at least you have forums and TikTok and Instagram, and you can complain about it all you want. Let it all out. That's what we're here for. But just be happy that you have something to actually complain about, rather than just, no, when's the lawsuit going to be over?
Well, let's remind the fans, let's remind the audience when and how the 13th they're going to be able to access the film.
So it's going to be completely for free on the YouTube Womp Stomp film. So youtube.com/WOMPSTOMPFILMS. You can go there right now. I would subscribe. You'll get a notice as soon as it's up. I haven't locked in this, but this is the date I've been kind of putting around, October 13th, 2020. But we're thinking about 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time premiere. So we'll start a premiere, you know, window earlier that day to let it lead up and be able to sit there. So 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. It will be in October, so maybe it will be a little bit darker out for everybody, and you can kind of sit up, turn the lights out, and sit down and watch it with your family. We want Friday the 13th fans from around the world coming together and watching it all at once on premiere night. It's a Tuesday, so it's not going to interfere with any of your weekend plans. It's going to be like coming home and watching the start of a new series. It's like the new start of Stranger Things or something on, you know, Fox or CBS or NBC or any other procedural show that you watch. It's kind of like starting a new season of that. The midweek, sitting down after dinner, you know, it's a nice half-hour episode, the first start, and then later that week you get to go and watch Candyman. So I like to kind of spin us as like we're the horror version of a Pixar short for your coming feature on Friday, and you can just kind of nibble on us as an appetizer until the big wigs come out and they release that beautiful movie, which I can't wait to see as well.
Well, do you have a couple moments off the air for us, Vincent?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we want to thank you so much for talking about not only Never Hike Alone, but Never Hike in the Snow, and what we can expect in the future from Womp Stomp and your contribution to the Friday the 13th mythology. We are eagerly anticipating the new film, so we cannot wait.
Great. Yeah, I can't wait for people to see it. I think it's another time for us to gather around and celebrate. It's the 3-year anniversary of the release of Never Hike Alone. That's why we really celebrated the date, and hey, it ended up being the same day that they're releasing the box set as well, which I'm a purchaser of and I cannot wait for. So
yeah,
October 13th is going to be a great day to be a Friday the 13th fan, and we hope, you know, fans choose to join in and watch with us and then follow our journey and join with us as we make more of these episodes and we march towards the second, third, and fourth episodes.
And we definitely encourage everyone to follow Womp Stomp, to follow Vincent on social media, so that once you start releasing news of some of the new items, things we can expect in the future, that fans are also getting that news in real time and sort of preparing to take the journey with you.